one of the things that has become apparent to me from some of the testimony that I have been privy to is that these are extremely advanced designs for what they are. You know, even as lighter than air vehicles, they have a tremendous amount of buoyancy. I mean, if you can take an entire armored division and move it from one place to another in a blimp of all things, I mean, you know, and maybe that's not the most appropriate term for it, but if you can do that, and you can use jet engines that are buried inside of the fuselage with a fairly substantial amount of ducting that comes from the inlets and goes back to, say, a nozzle, you know, say maybe as many as 6 nozzles. Imagine having anywhere from 6 to as many as 12 engines, the size of the engines that you'd find on a 747.
Okay. Yeah.
And they're down inside of
the fuselage. But they're pretty silent, these things.
Well, now, you see, you have to remember that there's an awful lot of technology that's been adapted to the practice of achieving stealth in the aerospace industry. They have electronic and acoustic cancellation of noise. I mean, part of what makes a jet engine make so much noise is the fact that when those high-velocity, superheated and compressed gases come out of the exhaust pipe of a jet engine, what you're really hearing there is the shear forces that occur between the jet exhaust and the surrounding ambient calm air. Now, if you're standing directly behind the jet, you know, say several hundred yards behind it, you will find that the noise at that location isn't nearly as loud as it is when you're standing directly beside the point where the exhaust gases come out. And I only know this because when I was in the Air Force and when I worked on F-106s, we occasionally would have to do an engine test. We'd run it up on the ground with the aircraft basically tied to the ground, big, you know, concrete pad with cables. And they would put the thing into full afterburner while we were standing right there with ear protection and everything. And the rumble coming off that exhaust blast was just absolutely dramatic.
Well, what are the possibilities, Mark, that this object is either extraterrestrial or man-made but reverse-engineered from some kind of extraterrestrial craft?
Well, you know, I can't completely discount that. You know, I don't really have the answer for that, George. I can speculate, but I would say this. If you've ever seen that film with George C. Scott about the Hindenburg disaster, one of the things that you may remember from that film is when they first get underway, one of the problems that they have with a large airship like that moving through the air, displacing the air, is that it builds up a tremendous static electric charge. In fact, there's been many people who have said they thought that this may have been the underlying cause of why the hydrogen ignited when this thing came in and was not properly grounded before it began to land.
Actually, too, I was told that a lot of the paint on the Hindenburg and the stuff like that caught fire first, mm-hmm. that the hydrogen fire was a secondary.
Well, that's entirely possible. But the point I was coming to was that if you have a tremendous amount of static electricity that you can tap right from the fact that you are pushing a huge vessel through the air, all of that static electricity can be stored in capacitors. And if the capacitors are properly structured, if they are properly designed, they themselves can actually be used as a propulsive force-creating device. And we know this from the work that was done by Agnew Bahnsen, Thomas Townsend Brown, and I think the third gentleman's name was Alfred Biefeld, also known as the Biefeld-Brown effect. Typically, you find this in what are called asymmetrical plate capacitors, where you have a number of parallel plates of a conductor with an intervening layer of some kind of insulating material, typical something like plastic or mica, or glass, quartz in some cases. And given the different sizes of these plates, you can create this actually a kind of levitating force by putting a high voltage electrostatic charge on the capacitor. And the plates are stacked up so they alternate in polarity. That is that you have a positive, negative as you go from the bottom to the top of the stack. And so imagine that you have conventional gasoline-powered prop engines pushing this huge vessel through the sky. It's building up a tremendous electrostatic charge, and then somebody says, well, why don't we see if we can't use that electrical charge and maybe do something with it? And then in the 1930s, when Alfred Biefeld and Thomas Townsend Brown first began investigating this effect, it's well within the realm of possibility that someone thought, where can we go to get a lot of static electricity for minimal cost, and it would be inside a blimp.
Gee. Well, okay, though, but again, extraterrestrial or reverse?
Well, in the case of some of the more modern sightings, there are some of these vessels, particularly the ones that are triangular in shape, that do suggest, and in fact, some of the sightings, particularly the ones in Europe, have shown a capability of a tremendous acceleration from a standing stop to nearly disappearing in a flash. And in that case, I would say we're not talking about a lighter-than-air vehicle. We're probably talking about something far more advanced, something more akin to anti-gravity or some kind of perhaps a warp drive, if you will.
Would the fellow who developed the patent on this, would he have found or stumbled across something extraterrestrial, or could it have been given to him?
Well, in the case of the Ariane Dynair ship, I don't think so.
Okay.
But in the case of some of these other vehicles now, there is a there have been a number of people that have described a triangular shaped anti-gravity vehicle that's been operated out of Area 51. It's actually been misnamed the TR-3A, and that was not an anti-gravity propulsion vehicle. It was a triangular shaped aircraft with conventional engines, a stealthy design. Somewhat like a flying Dorito, resembled the early A-12 designs from the 1980s. But this aircraft actually went into production and was produced between, I think, 1990 and about 1993 by McDonnell Douglas. And in fact, one of my sources indicated that there was a whole squadron of these aircraft based at Tonopah right now, and actually wound up cycling in as the stealth fighters were cycling out into their other duty stations.
So when do we see this officially unveiled, if we're using it right now, testing
it? Well, it depends on which system you're talking about. If it's something along the lines of a more conventional, conventionally powered aircraft, like the so-called TR-3A or TR-3B, the so-called flying Dorito in some circles, you're more likely to see something like that declassified soon. Some of the much more advanced systems, things that use or exploit exotic energy technologies, things like zero-point energy and things of that nature, it's a lot less likely that we're going to see those things declassified soon.